As we did on a couple of other recent Sundays, let's move and breathe a moment with a simple Tai Chi-like exercise. You can do this seated, but if it's comfortable for you, please feel free to stand and spread out just a little bit. Find a stable stance. Feel free to modify the movements to whatever suits you physically. But regardless of how you move, I invite you to tune into your breath during this. So to demonstrate, let your shoulders and arms relax. Then turning our palms upward, we raise our arms while inhaling deeply, timing our breaths with the movement. You can also rise on your toes if you want. Turn your palms down and exhale. Again, palms up and lift arms while inhaling. Rise if you like. And palms down as we release. Tuning into our body and breath. Up and inhale, mindful presence. And exhale, mental chatter. Inhale, peace. And exhale, any agitation. A little faster now. Inhale, energy. Exhale, lethargy. Inhale, gratefulness. Exhale, cynicism. Inhale, trust. Exhale, doubt. Inhale, joyfulness. Smile on this one. Exhale, pessimism. Last one. Inhale, spiritual expansion. And exhale anything that no longer serves you or others. Now we bring these positive energies together with hands over heart. And just breathe a time or two. Focusing on the inflow and the outflow. Grateful for each breath of life and the chance to share ours with others. And then turning palms together, we offer a little bow of thanks for this shared sacred moment. Thank you. Please be seated. So picking up from our reading recap, speaking very generally, the chief reason modernism's soulless abnormal condition became the norm has two interrelated facets, one proactive and one reactive, or we might say one stems from addition and one from subtraction. The prior two talks describe the core of the proactive or addition facet. The power of the Copernican revolution that sparked the larger scientific revolution, which greatly heightened confidence in human reason overall. To expand on this slightly, that confidence was well deserved. Besides the discoveries and calculations by Kepler, Galileo, and Newton previously mentioned, others applied the newly refined theoretical and methodological frameworks of scientific inquiry to make astounding advances in mathematics, physics, biology, human anatomy, and many other fields. Magnified by an explosion of printing that accelerated the diffusion and exchange of ideas and allowed scientists to build on each other's work, this approach also established the foundations of modern chemistry, began to understand the fossil record as a whole, and included the discovery of electromagnetism, microorganisms, and the speed of light. All of this, among numerous other breakthroughs we now take as givens, occurring before the year 1700. The scientific revolution certainly drew from prior influences and findings, both ancient and medieval. Yet as cultural historian Richard Tarnas stressed earlier, with its rational and empirical bases now anchored in Copernicus's transformed universe, its scope and power were unparalleled, its dynamism irrepressible, its thirst for knowledge unquenchable. Fueled by this revolution and extending from its latter decades of the late 1600s to the early 1800s, All these descriptors apply equally to the philosophical age of enlightenment. Also tellingly known as the age of reason, its intellectual innovators, among them Descartes, Rousseau, Locke, and Voltaire, likewise prized obtaining and appraising knowledge through empirical observation and rational inquiry. The earlier Renaissance of the 15th and 16th centuries had in part been born by a revived interest in the ideas of classical Greek philosophy, including the ideas that of Plato's on his view of the soul as a human being's essential defining quality, the divinity in each one, as he put it. Yet, since the soul can't be directly perceived, much less tested or otherwise subjected to proof, gradually the proactive developments of the scientific revolution and enlightenment threw its existence into doubt and eventually severed the intangible soul from the observable human body. This caused it to slowly slip into irrelevance and, understandably, given the circumstances, ultimately vanish from the modern materialist worldview. Which brings us to the equally understandable reactive facet of why its absence became the norm. This subtractive element begins with the fact that a key component of this new worldview's approach was to systematically question long accepted truth claims and increasingly insist on the complete freedom to exercise this critical thinking, and by extension, to critique the claims of those whose inherited right to rule was hitherto considered inviolable. Rising literacy rates and the unprecedented availability of reading material, which reinforced each other, made such intensive questioning and deliberations of the era's most pressing concerns visible to society at large like never before. These included emergent concepts related to innate human rights and individual liberty, judicial due process and the rule of law, religious freedom and tolerance, the latter being one of the Enlightenment's watchwords, and embryonic notions of what would become revolutionary forms of representative government. Concerning religious freedom, Immanuel Kant went so far as to declare that despite our prodigious rational capacities, as limited beings, humans can fully comprehend neither reality's ultimate character nor any infinite divinity that may exist. Hence, since all religions and their sacred texts are wrought by humans, none can be considered an absolute authority. Any that try by seeking to impose unquestionable dogmas merely extend humanity's immaturity and should be outlawed. The era's famed English poet, translator, and satirist Alexander Pope reinforced this in verse when he wrote, "Presume not God to scan. The proper study of mankind is man." Having worked for centuries to secure and preserve unyielding claims to such vital matters and lots more as their exclusive God-given territory, neither the extant monarchies nor the religions established or allowed by them took kindly to all this questioning of the social and sacred order. State and church were deeply entwined and, with many notable exceptions, largely bolstered each other's power. Yet focusing here on the more religious side, while in a prior talk I shared how philosopher and psychologist Eric Fromm said that generally the relationship to God was more one of confidence and love than of doubt and fear, this applied if a person believed as the Catholic and later Protestant authorities commanded. If instead you opted to make your own autonomous choices, that is, to be a heretic from the Greek heretikos, able to choose, a very different tone ensued. The refrain of one somewhat earlier troubadour's poem depicts the church's chastisement of choice in both senses of that phrase. If you do not believe, turn your eyes to the flames which burn your companions. Answer in one or two words only, You will either burn in this fire or join us. Indicating that maintaining social power was a principal motivation, a Standard Church Inquisitorial Handbook of 1578 states that, quote, abridged quote, punishment does not take place primarily for the correction and good of the person punished, but in order that others may become terrified and weaned away from the evils they would commit. This isn't an isolated example. When in 1612, King James I and a Church of England bishop condemned a man to be burned at the stake, the charges listed several specific wicked heresies and other cursed opinions belched by the instinct of Satan. The execution order stated that the offender should be before the people burned in the detestation of the said crime and for manifest example of other Christians that they may not fall into the same crime. And what was that crime? Questioning what the church said. And long after the death penalty for heresy and related transgressions was barred late in that century, other ecclesiastical penalties remained close at hand. No doubt, such instructive incinerations had a chilling effect on the open probes of nature and ideas championed by scientists and other free thinkers. And as psychologist Cassandra Wheaton remarks, the ashes still rain on such persons today. She says, I think there's a kind of collective post-traumatic stress disorder from the Dark Ages and the Inquisition. It's hard to believe how bad it was, how much they were relying on the perversions of religion. Once we finally started to enter the Enlightenment, there was a whole collective agreement that we're never going back there and never going to be that blind again. You betcha. So the abnormal annulling of the soul didn't just occur arbitrarily. Rather, the materialist surge formed a sorely needed corrective to counter rational and many times tyrannical religiosity. And as future talks and too often today's headlines abundantly demonstrate, since the blind faith of unquestioning conformity that still fuels such hyper-pious and sometimes lethal propensities is all too alive and unwell, it makes total sense that many modern people are so quick to take a pass on anything they see as non-rational. If I wasn't aware of a trans-rational third way, I would take soulless materialism and its relative freedom of choice over closed-minded religion every time. I say relative freedom of choice because for all of modernism's gifts, including this vital cultural corrective and so much that flowed from it, as seen in previous talks, it has its own blinders and at times deadly dogmas. Up to now, I've mostly addressed how the central one of evicting the soul harms individuals. And as we move toward a close today, I'll just hint at its more collective costs, which future installments will detail in full. Counting these costs, however, in no way dismisses or minimizes modernism's gifts. I am acutely aware that, like billions of others, I'm a beneficiary of so much that flowed from its discoveries. Just for instance, were it not for modern medicine, which is, while far from flawless, has eliminated or greatly relieved a host of abysmal physical and mental ailments, I, and statistically many of you, might not be alive today. Also, our service can potentially be joined by people from all over the planet, and, at least theoretically, without anyone's thoughts being suppressed or penalized by governmental or religious institutions. When we're done, we can all enjoy the engineering wonder of modern plumbing, not to mention downstream waste treatment. And later in our cars or homes with a few keystrokes, we're able to hear music from nearly anywhere in the world, many with sounds only produced by electricity flowing through instruments in highly controlled ways. So while humans have always fashioned new things, the endless wave of invention and innovation barely hinted at by these marvels stems directly from Sir Francis Bacon's 17th century encouragement to apply scientific findings to improving human life. That wave was heightened by applying the Enlightenment principles of free-thinking individualism to the exchange of goods as well as ideas. The ensuing tsunami of commercial initiative and ingenuity gradually overtook the medieval social and economic immobility mentioned earlier. Then, just like and pretty much just as the divine rights of monarchs were first being replaced with the inalienable rights of democracy, that mindset totally overthrew those cultural strictures. And though wretched poverty still existed, and unfortunately still does, the overall rise in material prosperity was unmatched in history. On the topic of waves, when I was a kid, a friend of my dad's had a small sailboat, and on shared family vacations, I sometimes got to serve as first, and due to its size, only mate, while he skippered on the waters of Wisconsin's Green Bay. As an aside, both boat and vacations were modest but telling markers of modernity's widespread prosperity. Years later, I once had the chance to sail on San Francisco Bay in a larger vessel of maybe 35 feet. I helped as needed, but with a few people aboard, we all had time just to enjoy the ride. And with the wind strong, we were zipping. At one point, I stepped out onto the bow plank, locked my legs against the surrounding railing, and in a forerunner of the iconic scene from the movie Titanic, a decade later, spread my arms to the breeze and blissfully rode the tall, sunlit swells. Leaning forward as far as I possibly could, I could have voiced the joyous cry that Kate Winslet's Rose character does to co-star Leonardo DiCaprio's Jack. I'm flying. To me, this captures the whole spirit of the burgeoning modern age. From the stunned awe of the Copernican discovery to the liberating and exhilarating evolution just outlined. A new world indeed took flight, and who could fail to esteem it as the most empowering cultural enhancement ever? And thus agree that history consists of, as Tarnas describes one view of it, an epic narrative of human progress, a long heroic journey from a primitive world of ignorance, suffering, and limitation to a brighter modern world of ever-increasing knowledge, freedom, and well-being. Yet, the Titanic, an archetypal paragon of modern scientific engineering and affluence, is a fitting symbol. For as French cultural philosopher Paul Virilio points out, quote, when you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck. When you invent the ship, you also invent the shipwreck. Hence, the same cultural voyage that produced such enormous benefits has also produced unequaled devastation. We'll pick up next week by examining some of that frightful flotsam. Namaste, and blessed be.